Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Brault. Hey there.
She's back.
Yes.
My name is John Steinbacher.
It's great to have you with us, John Steinbacher.
Yeah.
It's great to have Lisa.
It is great to have Lisa back after being out sick last time, although we couldn't let her be completely away from the episode. We stole her voice from a previous episode for the credits.
Amazing technology.
Yes, yes, indeed. So we've got a fun episode for you today. We'll be talking about when it's over, when you know that a season for your favorite team is just gone. There's no more hope. We'll talk about some various seasons that have gone that way, including one or two that might be headed that direction right now. We'll have a fun interview with Michael Dwojak. He's the managing editor of the Daily Illini. He wrote a great long-form piece for the DI here in the last week or so about concussions in female athletes. Check that out at dailyillini.com, but we'll get a taste of it with Michael here in just a few minutes. And then lots of Australian Open tennis talk. It was a great tournament down under this time around. We'll have kind of a wrap-up on that. Plus, that is the subject of this week's rivalry as well. All of that coming up this time on The Bandwagon.
I'm sure nobody has any idea who that's going to be about.
No, well, there actually were two great rivalries in the finals.
It's true.
So we could have it be about either one of them, to be honest. So we'll just let you hang in suspense there for just a bit. We'll start with when it's over. And I think kind of what our peg, if you will, for this is the current Illini men's basketball season, which seems to be sliding.
Right. Well, and we are recording this on Tuesday. It's very possible, though not likely, based on the season so far, that Illinois will have defeated number 10 Wisconsin, which would put them possibly in place to win a few games and maybe turn the season around. So I guess that's it. Yeah. If they lose tonight,
There are a lot of parallels, I feel, to this game tonight for Illinois and that game against number one Indiana.
Oh, yeah.
In John Gross's first year.
I had tickets that game, and I didn't go.
You didn't go?
Well, that's a longer story that I don't want to get into.
All right.
For personal reasons.
We'll save that for another time. But and things were very similar at that point in the season for Illinois men's basketball when they beat number one Indiana and went on to the NCAA tournament. Big Ten record was pretty similar. People were kind of down in the dumps about the team. And then they used that win against Indiana to kind of make a big run and get into the tournament, win a game, and people felt pretty good about the season. So we'll see if that's what happens in that game against Wisconsin. But barring that, John, things are just kind of sliding away here for Illinois basketball.
Right. And it's an interesting topic because, I think a lot – The Illinois has right now maybe the top one or two recruiting classes in the Big Ten for basketball, for men's basketball. So there's this like giant what if hanging over. If the class next year was weak, I think everyone would just be like, it's over and we know it's over.
Right.
But because they have this incoming class, and I think it's probably pretty likely that at least the top two prospects, Jeremiah Tillman and Trent Frazier, would likely at least consider leaving if John Gross goes, especially Trent Frazier, I think, because he's not from this area. He's very tied to the coaching staff. I don't know. That does put a little wedge into it, but the way that Illinois has been getting beat by 20 points on the road, down 20 points in the first half to Penn State, it's been very ugly, and I think a lot of people are ready to see John Gross go. So, yeah, I don't know.
I'm just baffled by how much strategy and sort of politicizing this all is. Like, you can't just like ditch a coach and say goodbye to a season. There are all these other factors that have to be weighed, like the incoming class and has he had enough time, and you know, if he has a pretty talented roster right now, what is he going to do to a talented roster in the future, you know, things like that. So I'm sort of not new to this idea, but it's very interesting to me to see really that there's a lot of politics and strategy and gaming of it in order to make the best decision. Whereas, like, when you talk to armchair coaches and referees, it's just, it's really simple, right? We're just like, get them out of here, get her out of here. And it's really never, it's never that simple to decide when somebody's time as a coach on a team is over, because they never decided unless they retire. It's always being decided for them.
Well, and the other thing is Whitman, with the hiring of Lovie Smith, has shown, I think, that he maybe can play sort of the bigger card. Like, as soon as he fired Cubitt, everyone was like, what the heck is going on? But he had one in hand. I kind of think, and it's, we've only seen that once, maybe based on that, he will not necessarily fire Gross until he knows what other alternatives are out there. Like, he's not going to just fire him to fire him if the coaching, you know, if the alternative coaches out there are relatively barren, which I think his predecessor is just like, fire everybody and then we'll figure out what happens next.
And that did not go well.
No.
Do you feel like the Illini-verse is just kind of, do you think people in general, not, I'm not talking about you guys, but just like people in general have written the season off?
For the most part, right.
I think so.
I
mean, like,
I
now it's just pain. It's just going to be pain in the pain.
I think if these games had been competitive, if they had the same record but they were competitive in every game, I think people would be a lot more understanding. But when you turn on the TV and within 10 minutes of the game you're down by 15, 20 points and the team just, you know, looks incomprehensibly bad, I think that really turns off a lot of people. But, you know, as we've said before, fan bases are very fickle. Yeah.
It makes it hard for us. So you talk about, like, public opinion. But, like, what about the people's from the public whose opinions matter a little more than
others? Donors?
Yes. And I'm talking about college sports here, obviously. How much does that factor in?
Oh, I'm sure it factors in a lot.
Like, really? Like, a donor is going to be like, I'm going to stop giving money if you don't make this decision
A donor, probably not.
But several donors, you know, telling Whitman, you know, it's time. I think they understand and they have confidence in him. Probably it was different with Mike Thomas because he was also trying to fund the State Farm Center. But I think if you had a lot of donors saying, you know, we love Illini sports and we want a winner and it doesn't seem like John Gross is that guy, he would definitely take that into account. Or, you know, or on the flip side, if everyone said, you know, we don't feel like John Gross has had a chance, he's had injuries, you know, it hasn't worked out this year because Thorne and Abrams haven't been who we thought they'd be. He's got a good recruiting class. You know, you're going to take a lot of heat, but give him a chance. I think that would go a long way.
So I have a question. I have a lot of questions in this segment. So is there a time that you can think of, and I'm sure there are many, and this can be any sport, it doesn't have to be Illinois basketball, it can be any sport, where the decision was made to keep somebody and it was the wrong decision? Like where it was like, yeah, we're going to go another year or another game or whatever, and then the way things played out, it was just like, oh, God, we should have.
I think there was a lot of chatter going back, I think it was 2003 in Illinois football, where Illinois had gone to the Sugar Bowl after the 2001 season. Then the next year they stepped back to like 5-7, I think it was, and they missed a bowl game. The following year, Illinois went, I think, 3-9. And there was a lot of talk about whether they should keep Ron Turner as the head coach or let him go. Well, Ron Gunther, the athletic director at the time, decided to keep Ron Turner for one more year. Well, the next year wasn't any better than the previous year. I think he wanted to give him one more chance. The one more chance didn't work out. That's when they brought Ron Zook in. And you could say something similar happened with Zook, although they changed up so much of the coaching staff at that point with Zook that it was almost like it wasn't his team anymore anyway. After Zook went to the Rose Bowl in 2007, Illinois in 2008 again went 5-7, missed a bowl game. Then the following year went like 3-9, and there was talk about, well, do we keep Ron Zook or do we let him go? Well, they kept him, but they made him bring in new offensive coordinator and a new defensive coordinator. Well, then the following year, Illinois was better. They went 6-6, went to a bowl game and won it. Then the following year, they started 6-0.
Oh, yeah.
Were ranked. then lost their final six games of the regular season, and that's when Zook got fired, et cetera. So I think in football that has happened. I mean, I think there were also some calls for Bruce Weber to get fired sooner than he did, but he was able to at least rebound somewhat and have a few more at least somewhat good years.
Well, and when you take a team farther than they've ever gone in the program's history, arguably some early possible national championships a long, long time ago, right? Don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, in the modern era, you get a lot of leeway, I think, even if you're using Bill Self's recruits.
Ah, yes. Yes,
I think one interesting that if Gross sticks around, barely makes it through the season and sticks around, the team next year probably won't be that great. I mean, they'll have a higher ceiling in terms of moving forward because of the recruiting class. So, I mean, I'm glad I'm not Josh Whitman.
What do you think the players think?
I think they like their coach.
Yeah, otherwise, I think so.
Okay.
The other thing, just to wrap a bow on this, is I think one time when you know you're, as a coach, when you know it's time to go is when you get offered the position of the defending national champions, which our volleyball coach, Kevin Hambley, just did. Yeah. So I can't. Sorry to see him go, but...
Dang, what a job, though.
Yeah.
And they called him.
Yeah.
Yeah, they recruited Kevin Hambley to come to the job. He's from California. That's where he grew up. So he's got some ties out there, of course. And, you know, when I first started covering Illinois volleyball in about 2005, 2006, Kevin was an assistant on the team. And between he and the then head coach Don Harden, they taught me a lot about the sport. So I, to this day, still consider Kevin a friend. So it's going to be difficult to see someone else in charge of that program. But, boy, yeah, you can't turn down Stanford. I mean, as he put it in some of his comments I saw in interviews yesterday, this job will not come open again while I'm coaching volleyball. Yep. So if I want this job, this is the time to take it. And you know, apparently Josh Whitman tried to convince him to stay with some increased compensation and everything else. But I think, you know, for Kevin and his family, it was the right move to make. So, you know, wish him nothing but the best.
Of course.
I still think we should try to get him on.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if we can swing that before he heads out west.
Tell us your strategy for Stanford.
Very good.
What do you think?
Yeah, we'll give that a shot. So we'll see if we can get Kevin on here as a future guest on the bandwagon. So that's a look at when it's over here on the bandwagon. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll have a conversation with Michael Dwojak from the Daily Illini. Stay with us. Michael Dwojak is the managing editor of the Daily Illini. He recently wrote a long-form piece for the DI all about concussions in female athletes. You can find it online at dailyillini.com. It's called Afraid of the Unknown, and Michael joins us in the studio today. Michael, thanks for your time today.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
Let's talk about this article. I came across it last week. I think one of the subjects of the article, softball player Ruby Rivera, had tweeted it out, and I came across it there and read through it. A lot of research went into this, really talking about the problem of concussions in female athletes. How did this idea come about for you?
Well, it's actually really funny. I didn't come into the idea of wanting to write about concussions. One of the biggest things among Illinois reporters for the past few years have been injuries, because so many players on the basketball team and the football team have been injured. So over the summer, I decided I'm going to document these injuries, and I'm going to look at all these different types of injuries. But then when I started getting deeper into the story, I kind of realized that I really don't have, like, a specific subject. I don't have, like, an exact focus, because heading into the school year, heading into August, I was just, like, very broad. But then I came into the topic after talking with someone and talking about how, yeah, these concussions are happening in football, but how much are they really happening in these other sports? Like, how much do we know? We know about women's soccer and that kind of stuff, but we don't know about softball. We don't know about volleyball. We don't know about basketball and the other sports, or ice hockey. So that's where I kind of got interested. So I started doing some preliminary research, and I found, hey, some researchers are finding stuff, that women have a higher rate of concussions. Women take longer to recuperate from concussions. And that's kind of where I came into this interest. And then once I find the research, I found subjects. Some of them I was lucky to find, honestly. And then some of them I just kind of knew from previous interviews, previous relationships, previous beats. So that's kind of how I got into it. I mean, it wasn't really an exact focus. It wasn't exactly like, oh, I'm going to write about women's concussions. It just kind of, I started on the subject, and it kind of led me down the way to report on this.
So after doing all of this research, could you put your finger on a reason why concussions in women is underreported? Because actually, once I saw the piece, I was like, you know what? I have actually, you know, it's always just concussions, like this sort of broad umbrella, you know, and most of the discussion has been about football. But women athletes, female athletes, more and more women are playing soccer and volleyball and other sports like you're talking about. Do you feel like that conversation is starting to ramp up a little bit? Do you feel like you broke something open here with this story a little bit?
That was a major question I asked practically everyone I asked. I asked them, why do you feel like concussions are being so heavily covered in football but aren't as important in these other subjects? And most of the answers I've been getting from all these different people, athletes, parents, coaches, is basically just on the popularity of the NFL and the popularity of football. Like, this is, I mean, America's sport. I know a lot of people say baseball is America's sport, but football has kind of evolved into that position. And we kind of get into that focus where people just, whether it's right or wrong, just kind of care more about football and that kind of stuff. But from what I have heard and talked to people, there has been this kind of sensationalism in women's sports, particularly women's soccer, in the past few years, where players are kind of starting to take a stance. You've seen, as I mentioned in the article, a few soccer players are donating their brain for CTE research and that kind of stuff. So there is a focus and there is like a sensationalism around women's concussions starting, but it's not to the level where, obviously, where I felt the need that I needed to write this article so people are more aware of it and that they kind of understand the subject, because as of right now, kind of like based on the headline of the story, the title of the story, there's so much still unknown. Like, we don't know. This is all like preliminary research. This is all theory. Like, the solutions are theory. Like, there's so much still that needs to be done. And that kind of starts with the knowledge and kind of starting with what I kind of wanted to do here and kind of get the word out about what these issues are.
I think you really did a good job of drawing the reader into this with leading off with the story of Ruby Rivera, who's currently a senior, I think, on the Illinois softball team. And back in her freshman year, about a play where she sustained a concussion and really didn't know what was happening at the time. How did you get in touch with Ruby and learn her story and decide that that would be kind of the focal point for this?
Well, I thought it was very, like, funny how that worked out, because Alex Booker, a former Illinois softball player who I also spend a section talking about in the story, I, during my freshman year at Illinois, did a story about her. So her and I have had a good relationship over the past few years. She's obviously moved on to life and that kind of stuff, but we still maintain a good relationship. And when I was doing the preliminary research on what athletes have to go through, when I was doing my general injury story, she mentioned that, hey, this person named Ruby Rivera, I don't know if you ever heard of her, she suffered multiple concussions and that kind of stuff. To which I was like, in my head, I was like, bingo, this is someone I can talk to. This is someone who's at the university right now. And then when I talked to her, I mean, it just wrote itself. Like, it kind of got at the theme where I was talking about, where she kind of knew she had a concussion, but like, she wanted to play through it because that's something she's always been told. Like I mentioned in the story, in high school, she suffered a concussion in the same way. And her coach didn't care. Her coach was just, like, more mad that she got out on the play as opposed to thinking, oh, are you okay? How are you feeling? So it's kind of getting upon that mentality that athletes have been grown up with and how that mentality is kind of changing in today's sports and that kind of stuff.
Except that you mention in the piece, you talked to Kevin Love, who's the director of soccer operations for Illinois Football Club or whatever they're called now. And he talks about how some parents were more frustrated with the no-header rule. So to explain, like, the national governing body for youth soccer banned heading the ball for kids, I think, 10 and under. Is that correct? Something like that. So and Kevin Love mentions that that parents were more frustrated than the players about it. And so what you're saying about the softball player and the coach being mad that she didn't want to go back into the game, it makes me wonder, like, you have all of this media out there about concussions and treatment and medical and making sure that, you know, they can recite the months of the year backwards and all of those things and being careful and having caution. These are people's brains. But then you also have, like, athletic culture, which is you rub some dirt on it to, you know, Probably the wrong metaphor, but you know what I mean.
No, I mean, I heard that metaphor so many times during these interviews. That's something that a lot of people say.
You just play through it, even if it's a head injury that can cause problems for the rest of your life. I mean, granted, an ankle or knee injury can also cause problems, but you can't. It's a lot harder to heal a brain that's been and rehab a brain that's been put through that. So, do you have any thoughts about that? Like, you're going to have this sort of media culture where, ooh, concussion's bad, we need to be careful, and then you have what's really happening with parents and coaches.
Right. And I think that's something that kind of surprised me. I mean, when I talked to Kevin and then Katie Stafford, a mother of one of the players, that was something they told me. They were like, well, parents are mad that you're kind of trying to change the sport, you're trying to change the rules. But I do feel like that's something where maybe that it is a majority of parents, but it's something that just kind of takes time to adjust. I mean, parents, I feel like, always want what's best for their child. And then sometimes, as I mentioned in the article, I feel like it was more, and this is based on what Kevin told me, based on more that someone was telling their child what they can't do, as opposed to them saying that concussions, like instead of them saying concussions are good, they're basically just kind of mad that someone else is telling them child what they can or cannot do, which I thought was really funny because I figured when it comes to brain injuries, you kind of would be okay with that kind of stuff. But according to them, that was kind of one of the main reasons, just because like parents just don't like it apparently when someone else tells their child what they can and cannot do.
In the article, you talk a little bit about how research has suggested that women maybe sometimes take longer to recover from concussions and maybe are slightly more susceptible to concussions. I'm just wondering, because there's already this stigma that obviously with athletics that, oh, girls just aren't tough as boys, which, you know, I think obviously my opinion is false, so that's not true. But do you think there's a stigma there going on too? Like, is that research controversial because of what it might be bringing to the surface? If that makes sense.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, you kind of see that stigma based on what these athletes have done. I mean, you've seen, like I mentioned earlier, Ruby playing through injuries because she thinks she might have a concussion, but she wants to impress her teammates. She wants to impress her coaches. So I could see the way where you would think that there is that stigma and there is that approach. But at the same time, you kind of have to separate that from what the stigma is and just kind of look at the facts and like look at the research based on if it is true that the preliminary research that women do have higher concussions and that kind of stuff, that's just a way of life. Like, you can't really, like, say – you kind of can't play upon that stigma. You have to do what's right for the player and you have to do what's right for the person, as opposed to putting that person in risk just because of looks and that kind of stuff. And you kind of have to build upon that. And I think that's kind of the kind of culture that this is kind of trying to shake away. You want to make sure that whether you're a male – female, whether it's concussion, an ACL injury, or a knee injury, or anything like that, you need to make sure that you're reporting it and you're doing what's best for you, as opposed to kind of falling into that fallacy that I kind of mentioned in my lead in the first section of the story, where I talk about how many athletes fall into like the trap of, well, I'm going to keep on playing because I need to impress people and I need to do my best, as opposed to thinking about my future and thinking about, especially with concussions, hey, how is this one play going to affect me 20 or 30 years from now when I'm trying to have a conversation with my child or having like trying to work because I'm not going to be playing softball anymore.
You know, you mentioned, you know, how female athletes may be more susceptible. It kind of reminds me of knees and ACL tears. It seems that female athletes have been more susceptible to those over the years as well. And it's just kind of accepted now that maybe you need to take some extra precautions with female athletes and their knees and how they cut, maybe wear a brace, that kind of thing.
Right.
Is that kind of where you see this maybe going with concussions as well, that, you know, training staff just needs to be aware that female athletes may be more susceptible?
Oh, definitely. And then something that I didn't mention in the story, but I did research, I talked to the Illinois soccer coach, Anna Rayfield, and something that she mentioned when I asked her about the changes that are taking place, she mentioned how, like, they're not going as hard at practice as they used to, especially when it comes around to head injuries or, like, heading the ball or anything like that. Obviously, they do the same for knees, ankles, and that kind of stuff, but when it came to concussions, she mentioned how they're really not going to mess around with that. Steve Whiteley, the head coach at Central, the girls' soccer team, also said the same thing. Like, coaches and players and parents are much more aware now, and they're kind of more cautious about that. Maybe it's not in their mind every time they're playing a ball or doing a free kick or anything like that, but it is something that they are thinking about, and it is something that they kind of are concerned about when they are planning their practice and when trainers are at practice and when they're kind of looking at the games and that kind of stuff.
So what about the headgear? Do you think we're going to see more of that as an additional preventive measure? I've seen it a little bit in club soccer now in, like, teenage girls. Mm-hmm. Haven't seen it as much on younger kids because they're not supposed to be heading the ball, but there's still the potential for getting a ball in the face or
right.
whatever. Do you think we're going to see more of that?
Honestly, it depends on who you ask. Like the research, it's just there's so much preliminariness surrounding this where these brands, I've talked to numerous headband companies, and none of them can claim to reduce concussions. None of them can claim to do any of that. If they do, like many people told me, they're just lying. You can reduce the risk of having a concussion. But other than that, it's not a foolproof thing where, oh, if I wear this headband, I'm not going to get concussed. Many doctors are against it. Many doctors are for it. So it's still very, like, up in the air right now. I've had CEOs or owners of these companies tell me that there are doctors who are told to be against concussions based on orders from FIFA and Team USA. Like I mentioned in the story, Team USA was kind of ordered their own players not to wear these concussions, according to one of the people I talked to. Based on the look of it being scary for soccer moms and them not wanting to wear concussion bands and that kind of stuff. The one way he kind of compared it to was shin pads and how FIFA kind of felt that shin pads were forced upon the world based because of the U.S. So that's something that was kind of interesting and something where there's a lot of research left to be done on what these headbands can do, the technology that can do. But like many parents told me, if it can improve it at least a little bit, why not wear it? Why not demand to wear it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like I said, there's still like no definitive proof that these headbands are working, but it is something where people are going to keep on looking at it. Doctors are going to keep on fighting over it until we finally find a right solution of how to kind of, instead of getting that, reduce the risk of concussions, kind of getting that, hey, let's just flat out say we can reduce concussions based on these standards and based on these levels.
So basically, the only way to not get a concussion is not to play.
Basically. I mean, yeah. But that kind of takes
away. Or to be at risk for one.
Right.
You know, I can speak as a parent of a kid who played soccer all the way through high school. It was like my hugest fear was, and there were a couple times where she took a ball to the face, and there was another time where she got upended by another player and kind of landed on her head. And she was fine both times that I remember being really nervous about it. But as a parent and probably as a coach too, depending on, you know, what level you're at, your heart is always in your mouth when your kids are playing any sport. Softball, it had never even occurred to me, but you see so many collisions in baseball and softball that you have to wonder if players are having concussions more frequently, and they might not even know. They might be like, whoa, yeah, my bell got rung, but I'm fine. And it doesn't even occur to anybody because it's not a contact sport to look more into it.
Right, and that's kind of one of the fallacies I kind of wanted to dispel, where research shows that only like around 30% of concussions in soccer happen through headers. That's like a small number compared to everything else. Because when I was talking to parents and coaches, they were telling me, yeah, like the examples I gave in the story, one person got hit in the head by an errant ball. The other person got kicked in the face by the ball. Another person got run over when she was playing basketball. So, like, these aren't injuries where, like, players are playing with their head purposely or, like, trying to get a concussion or anything like that. These are just, like, fluke plays. And, like, when I talk to all these different people, they say, like, hey, you don't have to be playing a sport. I mean, you can wake up the wrong way and fall on your head and suffer a concussion.
But I do recall seeing some research done that that even in football, a lot of the concussion results weren't, or like the brain damage, long-term damage, wasn't necessarily because of head-to-head hits. It was repeat hitting the ground, repeat jarring of the brain. And in soccer, especially the higher up you go, once you're in college, especially for girls, the expectation is that the game's going to be played in the air a
yes.
fair amount.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So, so if you have players hitting the ball with their heads in practice and then in games and over again, I mean, I have to think that I'm talking about two different things, sorry, but like where it's like, you know, repeated use of the head in sports that can have a long-term effect. And then there's the issue of like a concussion, like a blow causing a concussion, and then missing it or not, or ignoring it.
Right, and that's kind of where the whole CTE kind of comes into play, where obviously CTE has been known to be a football injury, but that's obviously not true. The only problem is, as I mentioned in the article, there's no research being done on women's soccer players because they have no brains, to put it flat out like that. Like, they just literally have no brains to do any research on. And I know there are players who have said they're going to donate their brains and that kind of stuff, but that's, what, in another 50 years, in another 60 years? So there's so much that can happen, but just still can't because just lack of resources and that kind of stuff. And that's kind of a big thing that I realized when I was trying to talk to the BUCTE Center, where I asked them, like, hey, is there any, like, differences in between football players and women's soccer players, or even just men's soccer players and women's soccer players? And the researcher just couldn't say anything because we don't have anything. That was basically his answer. Like, I could give you, like, a hypothesis, but, like, I don't want to do that because it would be inappropriate and it just wouldn't work because we just have no idea.
Well, this was actually an amazing article, and it sounds like the research that you did was exhaustive. And I like, hearing that there are parts to the story that didn't even make it into the article, like talking to Coach Rayfield. So this is part of the Daily Illini's long-form series. I noticed that there's stories about all types of topics. It's not just sports. You mentioned off mic that you're a senior. Are we going to see another piece from you, sports-related, before you graduate?
Hopefully. I mean, I've been feeling bored this week without it really having anything to do. You kind of get entrenched into the research and planning out, like, I'm going to interview this person at this time. I'm going to interview this person at this time. You kind of get into the moment. And it's funny because we've talked to Mike Sager in one of my classes in the past week, and he was kind of talking about how he has that absence sometimes when he doesn't write a story. So ideally, hopefully I'll write a story. Like you mentioned, on our long form side, we have a lot of great stories. It's not just sports. It's about we have a black story about a black engineer and the lack of that kind of community in that respective major. We have profiles and stories. There are other sports stories. I mean, I've done two other stories on the long form side, one about the relationship between the university and Nike, and then the other one about the recent State Farm renovations and the kind of the branding of arenas in the nation. I've had other people we've done profiles on Dave Downey and Manny Jackson, former Illini basketball greats. So, I mean, like, it's a great place to kind of see where students can kind of delve into, as opposed to just writing these 500, 1,000-word stories, they can kind of delve into and write these kind of longer stories and kind of these more in-depth stories. It's kind of one of the great opportunities we've kind of developed at the Daily Illini over the past year, where we can offer that. We can make it look like you're on ESPN, which was like
oh,
it was
the site's beautiful.
Well, that was
great.
That was one of the coolest things, like when we debuted with my story last year on State Farm Center. Just like, it looks awesome. Like, if you're a kid and you're a journalist,
oh my God.
And we were just like, we're practically writing for ESPN, obviously not the same like audience or anything like that, but like, it still looks awesome. And like, if you plan it out, we can do graphics and all that kind of stuff. It really turns out to be a really cool thing. So hopefully we can continue to do great work on that side, and so we can continue to do and address issues such as these.
Yeah, well, great job on this, Michael. As Lisa said, a ton of research. You can see all sorts of great graphics, including what the Fighting Illini concussion protocol is for head injuries. Find that at dailyillini.com. Click on long form, and this article, Afraid of the Unknown, will be right at the top of the page. Michael Dwojak, managing editor of the Daily Illini, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks again to Michael Dwojak for joining us on the bandwagon this week. Now it's time for some tennis talk.
I love tennis talk.
Yeah. Lisa is by far the biggest tennis fan among us. John actually plays.
Yeah, John plays.
So he can tell us a little bit more actually about, you know, what happens if he actually watches it.
And he won't. Tell him why you won't.
Tell him why I won't what?
Watch.
You don't watch tennis, really, or that?
Oh no, I watch tennis. I don't watch the Australian Open because it's hard for me to get into it. Like after I know who won. Like tennis is one of those sports where the drama is so thick in the moment, and I, you know, I'm not trying to tell anyone who doesn't enjoy just the beauty of the sport to watch it. But for me, it's like, you know, that fifth set, well, I'll let you talk about it, but just knowing that...
Well, you can,
And basically, the Federer... Why can't I think of his name now?
Nadal?
Nadal. Nadal's set went five sets, and apparently Nadal was up 3-1, and then Federer won 6-3. That would have been amazing to watch live.
Right.
But since it was overnight, I didn't watch it. Last year, not this year, I had insomnia just at the right time, and I enjoyed that.
That's helpful.
I have a hard time watching, like, tennis or hockey, for example, are two sports that if I'm not watching them in real time, I have a real, probably baseball, too, if I'm being totally honest, except for maybe a few games. But.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, Aussie Open was just awesome this year.
It was awesome. And I love the Australian Open. It might actually be my favorite of the Grand Slams for a lot of reasons. Number one, I definitely need a dose of like sunshine this time of year in January. And it's always like 1,000 degrees down there. And everybody's like tan and sweaty and the sun is shining and people are fanning themselves in the stands. So I'm really into that. So there's that whole idea of like... And actually, like, it hasn't even been that cold this January. I can say that because today is the last day of January. So there was that. But it was just it was a spectacular tournament this year. I didn't really keep track of how it was going. Maybe in the first week, I watch a lot of replays. Unlike John, I will watch tennis when I get home. I'll get caught up on all the stuff that I missed. We could watch it in prime time. They were just getting started for the day down there at 6:00 p.m. here, so we could watch some of the early day matches, which got progressively more interesting as the tournament went on. There were, you know, I'll get to the finals matches in a second. But one of I do want to mention, do you guys know who Bethany Maddox-Sands is? She and her doubles partner won the women's doubles, and she has got the best fashion, or some people would argue anti-fashion. She wears knee-high black socks and like sort of crazy shorts. She also played mixed doubles too. I don't think they advanced as far. And she actually has played as a singles player in various tournaments and has made a couple quarterfinal runs and some of the Grand Slams and stuff. But anyway, I love watching her. Like one of these days she's going to show up with a feather boa out there, and you know, but she's incredibly athletic. We were talking as we were preparing for this show about fitness in tennis. And she's another one of those athletes, I think, that doesn't fit like this idea of a female tennis player. You know, she's a little shorter, a little more powerfully built. And then she's got this outrageously loud fashion sense. So she's super fun to watch. And she's very active on social media. So she talked a lot about the tournament there. So love Bethany Maddox-Sands. You keep doing you, girl. It's totally great. So anyway, the tournament's going on. I also would get up early, and sometimes they'd still be playing because the marquee matches would start at 2:00 in the morning, our time, typically. So I woke up when Nadal... early when Rafael Nadal was playing the match that got him into the final. And that was very dramatic. Sergei Dimitrov, I think is his name. Great player. I actually think he's going to be one to watch for sure as like these aging dudes finally retire. He's going to be one to watch. But it was an incredible match. And I am a bad fan of Rafael Nadal. And I have to say, like, he's been injured. Everybody keeps talking about Federer's injuries. Nadal's been injured, too. All kinds of injuries. Hand, wrist, you know. He seemed out of shape the last couple of years. And when I saw him start playing in this Open, I was like, man, his physique looks like he's trimmed down. He's fast and powerful. He's cut his hair. It's like a whole new lease on life. But anyway, I'm a bad fan of Nadal because I can't remember exactly what happened, but he was down. It wasn't looking good. I'm like, fine, I'm going to go upstairs and get dressed for work. This is over. Terrible fan. I'm a terrible fan. I come downstairs and they're interviewing him. And I'm like, since when do they interview the person who lost?
They didn't.
Yeah, it took me a second to figure out what was going on. And then I was just like delighted. And then the hashtag was going around social media, Fedal. So you don't have to remember Rafael Nadal's last name. You can just call it Fedal. People got their Fedal on the men's side. And then, of course, Fed won. He was terrific. It was great. I did not get up in the middle of the night to watch that match, however, so watched it on the replay.
And one thing that was interesting about that, I think that was Grand Slam number 18 for Federer. And I think had Nadal won that, there might have been at least an outside chance that Nadal could have caught Federer in Grand Slams. But now with a four Grand Slam lead, I just can't see Nadal. I don't think he's going to win four more.
I don't know. He's only 30. Mm. So although, as my father so helpfully pointed out to me on Facebook, 30's old in tennis, and Federer's 34.
Well, it used to be.
Right.
And I think, you know, I was looking, like, when did certain people retire? And the average age of retirement for a guy tennis player seems to be in their early 30s. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got Wawrinka, who I think is 30 years old or around there. He looks older, though. Like I've mentioned before, he looks like he just rolled out of bed and started playing tennis a lot of the time. So sometimes he looks a little bit older. Federer looks exactly the same. I don't know how he does that. But I think when a player, and this is true in any sport, right? Like when a player's had a lot of injuries, it is really hard to maintain at a high level, especially when you've got 22-year-olds chasing up behind you with their 4,000-mile-an-hour serves. I remember when it was a big deal when a guy served over 100 miles an hour. Now the women routinely serve over 100 miles an hour. So, and then, of course, Venus and Serena ended up playing each other. So on the men's side, it was like tennis 10 years ago, basically. Those of us who've been watching for a long time were like, oh my God, we get this again. Like, this is amazing. You know, 10 years ago, it was sort of the heyday for all of those players. And it's still Serena's heyday, I would say. So it was fantastic to see. And now we have this, like, incredibly long drought before the French Open. I don't know what to do with myself. But anyway, it was great. And I probably will satisfy myself by watching lots of replays. Yeah, so anyway, that's my report. Does anybody have anything to add? Did you guys watch anything?
I did not. It doesn't really work for my schedule either.
Oh, that's true. Although you could get up and they'd still be in the middle of some of these matches.
Yeah,
I'm
not going
to
get up any earlier to watch tennis.
I can report that I need to go to Atkins. This conversation reminded me I need to go to Atkins to pick up my racket because I just got it restrung. It's supposed to be done today. So.
See, like, even restringing of the racket. I'd play with a thrift store racket if I play tennis right now.
Yeah, that's basically what I play with, like, when I get it out once a year.
I got a lot of topspin. I break a lot of strings.
Well, so here's the other problem with the Australian Open that Brian ran into is, like, if you talk about the scores before people have watched their DVRs or their replays, they get really grumpy about it.
Yeah, I had a guy who was a little cranky with me about that. But that's okay, David. I don't hold that against you.
No, I mean, it's all good, and I get it, but it's the nature of the beast.
Yeah, it is. So that's kind of the full report on the Australian Open. But we're not done talking tennis because it is...
I'm never done.
...rivalry time.
Rivalry time. So, yes. So, the rivalry this time is a tennis rivalry. And as we mentioned, Fedal was a thing. But that's not the rivalry I'm going to talk about. To me, the most interesting rivalry for a lot of different reasons in this tournament is the rivalry between the Williams sisters, Venus and Serena Williams. If you've been following tennis at all in the last two decades, you know all about Venus and Serena. I was thinking, this is how I know I'm, like, old, too, because I feel like they've always been playing tennis, but they continue to win and really, especially Serena, but Venus has been coming up right behind her. They continue to dominate women's tennis. They really haven't let other people, Serena especially. I'm going to just default to Serena every time. It's been really hard for anybody else to top her for any length of time.
23 Grand Slam titles now.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's absolutely amazing. And what's amazing about Venus, who is a year older than Serena, is that she has an autoimmune disorder. And so she was sick, then she had to figure out what was going on, and now she plays through it. And so I have a lot of respect for that. She's 36 years old, I believe, and is still totally kicking butt. I love watching Venus play because her style of play is completely different. I like the contrast between the two sisters. But if you've been watching tennis, you know that they've been playing since they were young teenagers and continue to dominate today. What I find interesting about the rivalry, among other things, is the fact that they're sisters and end up having to play each other from time to time. And before they faced each other in the Australian Open final, I think it had been a couple of years. maybe even close to 3 years since they had played against each other. And I don't think they like it very much. You know, some of the reading and the interviews that I've seen, they're not – they don't love playing against each other. They don't get all excited. And I often wonder, like, what does their mom do? Does she go from box to box? You know, do the families sit near each other? Like, or, you know, different parts of the family? Is it kind of like, I'm going to root for Serena this time. You got Venus this time. You know, like, how does that work? But it's not a contentious rivalry. It's not divisive. It's just, it's really, but it's intense. And I think being siblings and being competitive as they are and being raised to be really competitive by their father, you know, they have to be competitive as young Black women going up through tennis and dominating and dealing with a lot of stuff. So they have to be competitive on the tour, but they also have to be competitive with each other. You don't want to give up your, you don't want to not play your best because you're playing your sibling, right? So mm-hmm. I feel like that adds a lot of tension. And I, for one, if you had told me 15 years ago that they would still be playing this late and they would be playing against each other in the final of a Grand Slam, I would have been like, you are crazy. But here we are.
Yeah. And Venus in particular, as you mentioned, you know, some of the health issues she's dealt with, for her to still be making Grand Slam finals at the age of 36 is pretty impressive.
It's awesome. And after she won her match, her semifinal match, there was a GIF going around the internet of this amazing twirl that she made, like this Venus twirl. She was so excited and thrilled to be there. Now, which is hilarious because the second she won, her face changed. Like, she had been all like game face and tough and like intense. She had wicked, wicked eyeliner. Eyeliner game very strong. Like she, and then, but the second she won, her whole face and body language, everything changed, you know, and it just sort of also tells you how hard I think it would be to be an athlete competing at that level where your focus has to be so incredibly just like laser pointing, you know, and you don't think about anything else. You're just completely focused on what you're doing. And then as soon as that pressure is off, you can like be yourself. So yay. I'm like Team Venus right now, but I love the Williams sisters. They've done so much for the game and they're incredible women.
Well, and like you said, they've both come a long way. And I think Venus, it's interesting because she became famous and was in the spotlight much sooner, and sort of as like the big sister in a relationship, it's you know, she probably took a lot of the young Black tennis woman, and I understand at this point Serena takes a lot of it too, just because she's more famous and become sort of a bigger celebrity, but out there from the throngs of people who maybe are still shockingly uncomfortable with this kind of stuff, which is really unbelievable. But I do think it's interesting to see how that's evolved over time. And what do we say the all-time? It's like head-to-head?
It was 16-11 in favor of Serena before that match.
And those are just in majors?
That was all time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so... in majors, I think Serena has a bigger advantage.
Well, I'm curious to see, like, once they retire, if it ever happens, are they going to play the circuit, be a doubles team? How are they going to open an academy? What are they going to write books? Like, they already have so many other projects, you know, going on, whether it's, like, clothing and makeup or whatever it is that they're doing. I just wonder what is next you know, because you still aren't seeing a lot of players of color on the tour. You're seeing some Americans and some American women, but by and large,
And like you said, they've been at it enough that someone, a girl might have been like 2 or 3 years old when they first started winning and now should be in their 20s. So, yeah, we should have started seeing that a little bit. But.
Yeah, well, I mean, but tennis is expensive to get once you move into the real, like, you know, real training. You're not playing like rec tennis or whatever.
Right.
I mean, it's expensive. The Williams sisters were homeschooled growing up, so they didn't have like the usual school kind of things that can, you know, they were able to move a lot faster. let's just say. But anyway, that's my rivalry. I think they're amazing, and I hope we get to see them play in a final again.
All right. That's a good one, the Williams sisters, this week's rivalry. Before we wrap things up, it is time for our status update. What has caught our eye on social media this week? Can I go first?
Go first.
So apparently the latest big celebrity feud in the NBA is LeBron James and Charles Barkley. Apparently, you know, Charles has been busting LeBron's chops for a while. Just last week, he called LeBron inappropriate, whiny, all of the above, basically saying that the Cavaliers have given LeBron everything he wanted, and he's still complaining that they don't have enough good players. LeBron finally had enough. He told ESPN last night, he's a hater. What makes what he says credible? Because he's on TV? He then expounded on that a little bit. I'm not going to let him disrespect my legacy like that. I'm not the one who threw somebody through a window. I never spit on a kid. I never had unpaid debt in Las Vegas. I never said I'm not a role model. I never showed up to All-Star Weekend on Sunday because I was in Vegas all weekend partying.
Wow.
So LeBron's had enough of Charles ripping on him and finally just went off. And I say good for you, LeBron.
Yeah.
Good for you,
LeBron. Did Charles even ever win an NBA title either?
No. Got to the finals.
Oh, yeah. Ran into certain Michael Jordan.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So LeBron has gone off on Sir Charles.
Or the round mound of rebounds.
Yes,
I've really enjoyed
yes.
that nickname over
That's
the years.
A good one.
That's a good one.
All right, who's next?
I'll go, I guess. So in England right now, in soccer, in English Premier League soccer or in English soccer, they have this thing called the FA Cup. I don't know what FA stands for. No idea. But what it is, the concept of it is so great. So like in England, there are like 8,000 soccer teams. Mm-hmm. I'm not even exaggerating because you have everything from like, you know, the Manchester Uniteds and
Premier
the Liverpools
League.
And all that,
yeah.
all the way down to like the smallest little town has an arena and a side. They've got a team.
Yeah, it holds like 500 people.
Yeah.
A town of 2,000 or whatever.
Exactly. So the FA Cup allows big teams and small teams, everybody's in the draw. Like they play through and they advance to the next level, you know, through whatever level of soccer they're in, and they're able to play. So this team called Sutton United, don't even know where that is they drew Arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
So Arsenal, huge, big team, very important, lots of superstars. And Mark Donaldson of ESPN tweeted, quote, Alexis, you and Mesut can take the bench beside the bin and the fire extinguisher. And he posted an image of Sutton's locker room because they are going to be playing. Arsenal is going to play at Sutton at a stadium that holds 500 people. I was watching a match last weekend where somebody kicked the ball, you know, over the goal and it landed in someone's backyard. Like, it's amazing. But the picture, and we'll post it online, of this locker room, you literally, somebody's going to sit next to the fire extinguisher. Someone else is going to sit next to the bin on the other side. It is a tiny locker room. And when you see, so the locker rooms in English Premier League soccer and all the big soccer are very much like the football or
the
basketball
palaces,
locker rooms.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just like, you know, everybody's got their uniforms laid out just so in a new pair of cleats and they've got all this room. And here they're going to be crammed right next to each other, and it's going to be awesome.
It's like they're back in junior high.
Exactly. And for some of these guys, not even that.
Yeah,
you know, and so I just thought that was really funny that I love the way that, and sometimes a team will make a really good run or pick off a really good team. Like teams like Arsenal kind of, they don't go into these matches ever thinking like, we got this. I mean, somebody like Jamie Vardy came from a team, Sheffield, that's a lot like Sutton United, you know, where you can have these really good players showing up out of nowhere and kicking your butt if you're not paying attention. So anyway, that's my status update.
Cool. What do you got, Steinbacher?
Well, it's been
just shake your head and there, like.
There's been I don't know. Kyle Schwarber was like on the local news and been photobombed something. Is that good enough?
That's good enough. That was making the rounds.
There's a lot going on in the world, and regardless of your political.
Thanks for reminding me.
Persuasion. I'm guessing you've been getting funneled a lot of news and all sorts of social media, so I got nothing. I don't know. Steve Kerr said some stuff. Greg Popovich said some stuff. There's an article in the New York Times that was a couple months ago about Steve Kerr. A month and a half ago about Steve Kerr's family history.
Yeah, you posted that.
That's a good one. Let's talk about that.
Again?
Steve... Did we talk about it?
I think we did.
Yeah. Well, I got nothing.
Well, no, but like to your point though, I can't remember the player. Never mind. There, somebody asked the player about the immigration ban.
Kyle Lowry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said some expletives.
And he, lots of expletives. And then a reporter said, hey, do you want to try that again without the swearing? He was like, nope.
Nope. That's how I feel.
That's how I feel. Exactly. I saw that this morning. That cheered me right up. I love it when people swear in front of reporters because they don't know what to do.
Well, because, well, and
if, I mean, if sorry, I know you're a reporter.
If you're a reporter in radio or television.
And it's live. Whoops.
Either it's live and you get in trouble from the FCC.
Right.
Or it's on tape and you can't use it.
But,
so.
Right. Since this is a podcast, we are allowed to say shit.
Can you beep him?
Can you beep me?
Yeah. No, see, because that would have been even funnier about Kyle, the video with Kyle, is if they had beeped him because it was, he did not hold back. He wasn't even angry about it, like in his tone. He just.
It was very matter of
fact. Exactly. That is exactly how I would describe it. Well done, Brian. That was good.
All right. So that's our status update for this week. A busy week here on the bandwagon, but
we're
we
back.
Can't say goodbye without some credits.
Right. So I just. On behalf of all of us here, I want to thank you, yes, you, for joining us on the bandwagon. Special thanks to our guest, Michael Dwocheck, from the Daily Illini, for joining us today. Thanks, Michael. Today's Bandwagon podcast was produced by Brian Moline, Lisa Braltz, and John Steinbacher. There are other people who have helped make the bandwagon a thing despite the odds. We know them as Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, the band REM, and again, you, especially you. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon. We link to everything we discuss here, videos, audio, social media accounts, etc. You can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Do that. And while you're at it, rate us. It helps other people find us, too. You can find us pretty much wherever you get your podcasts, actually, so it's not just iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at bandwagonpodcast. Just leave out all your vowels, and we'll be right there. To get our most recent thoughts on stuff, or my most recent thoughts on stuff, you guys aren't posting very much in there, so you got to get on it. We all have our own Twitter accounts, too. You can follow each of us if you want to. We like questions. We like links. We like recommendations. So please fling them our way. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with a brand new show. Thank you so much for listening. You're the best. We puffy heart you with glitter, and we'll see you soon.